Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. It's summer and Jonesy himself is nowhere to be found, off climbing mountains in Tibet, or more likely, flushing top-secret documents down the toilet. So we'll be re-airing an interview I did for Between the Covers back in May 2020, the early days of the pandemic, with author Adam Levin. The occasion was the launch of Adam's novel Bubblegum from Doubleday. And the timing is perfect. Adam's latest novel, Mount Chicago, was released this week, and I can't wait to read it. Meanwhile, hope you enjoy listening while we cover bubblegum, speculative fiction, narrative voice, pet robots, cute aggression, and a world without the internet. In the words of George Saunders, Adam Levin is one of the wildest writers and our funniest, and bubblegum is a dazzling accomplishment of wit and inventiveness, an irrepressible and insanely entertaining examination of our obsessive culture that doesn't forget to be fond of that which it is satirizing. Levin's keen and ornery mind, reveling in the world with vast energy, shows us new ways of loving it. Please join us for our conversation with Adam, which is already in progress. Adam, thanks for joining us today on Between the Covers.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Adam, I have the bound galley for Bubblegum in my hands here. I haven't yet seen the final hardcover edition. Does the cover jacket really smell like bubblegum?
It does. It does.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's a nice thing. It goes a bit with some stuff in the book. There's some things in there that smell like bubblegum, and it kind of. Yeah, I won't say more than that. It's pretty cool, though. Yeah, and it's, and you could take it off if you hate the smell of bubblegum. You know, it's just the jacket.
Yeah. Now, in the book, you play on bubblegum in several ways. And I know in a previous interview, you didn't really get into the ways that you play on them, the kind of how it works as a motif and a symbol. But I wanted to give a little background first on the plot, which I think will be helpful. The novel's structured as a memoir by a possibly psychotic writer, Belt Magnet. He's 38 in the present day of the narrative, and that's the year 2013. And he's living with his father in Chicago's suburb. He's on disability. His father's away from home. Belt goes to the corner store for cigarettes, but he has no money, comes away with only a pack of bubble gum, double bubble, which the store owner gave him just to get rid of him because he's not credit worthy. Belt then goes home and ponders, you might say chews on, and I had to get that bad pun in there, why bubblegum loses its sweetness. To start us off, I wonder if you could read an excerpt from that section.
Absolutely.
The one starts on page 21.
Gum, I was thinking, was an old-timey product. And I supposed that in its early days, back when the practice of professional dentistry entailed little more than extracting black teeth from rotted-out jaws, it was understood simply to be a soft candy its job was to continually sweeten your mouth for longer intervals of chewing than other soft candies, such as caramel or taffy. This old-timey gum was not, I supposed, nearly as elastic as the gum of today. And I supposed the elasticity a piece of it possessed would be greatly depleted, if not entirely lost, as soon as you'd chewed all its sweetness away. That once it went bland, it rapidly stiffened. And if you kept chewing, you'd weaken its integrity until it came apart in rigid, stringy bits that caught in the creases of your throat when you swallowed. But then, I supposed, double bubble was invented. And what made it different wasn't its flavor, which was just as basically sweet and short-lived as the flavor of any other brand of gum, but its extra chewability. It started more elastic than the other brands of gum and maintained its elasticity for dozens of minutes beyond the loss of its sweetness. You could keep on chewing for a really long time. So what, though? Why should you? Why continue chewing? If the sweetness was gone, what incentive did you have?
Oh, I think that gives us a real taste of Belt's voice. His thoughts, as the listener can hear, are very analytical and detailed. And the seemingly mundane musings that he has here can carry great weight. I love that last line that you read. Why continue chewing if the sweetness was gone? What incentive did you have? You could read a lot into that. I wonder how you arrived at Belt's voice. How did you differ that from your own voice and from Gurian in your first novel, The Instructions?
Well, I think, you know, it's always hard to say. I write really, really line to line. So I think, you know, I basically throw a bunch of stuff at the wall until a line sticks. I think before I got started, before I wrote anything in this book that ended up remaining in the book, that ended up being the sort of first line of the book, I probably threw away, you know, 300 pages, something like that. And I think that what I found I wanted to do, and it started happening to me toward the end of writing the instructions, and then while I was working on maybe this one story in Hot Pink, was I really wanted to have kind of longer sentences. I wanted sentences, not just for the sake of being long. I wanted to have every sentence sort of have more packed into it, kind of anecdotally and analytically, than I previously had. And so I had to figure out this way to do that, basically, to sort of use parentheticals in what's hopefully a not obnoxious way, and sort of have sentences encased within sentences while still having it sound spoken, because that's really important to me. I don't like that sort of what a lot of times gets called stream of consciousness writing, I guess. That's not really my thing. I want everything to be something I can utter. And so, but to be able to do that and have, you know, there's a lot of sentences in here that are significantly over 100 words long, and to be able to do that and still have it be something that someone might say, I think it just, I just kept working at it. And finally I started nailing it, and I got the first sentence, and then kind of went forward and said, okay, now this is the voice. I got to keep this up.
Yeah, it works well. It's a very distinct voice. I know in that you did this great Concavity podcast recently, which is focused on David Foster Wallace's work.
Yeah.
And they mentioned at the end big books, and one they mentioned was a recent one, Ducks Newburyport, which happens to be pretty much one sentence, so not exactly conversational.
Yeah. I'm not speaking ill of that, but I haven't read it. But I haven't read it either. Yeah. It didn't exactly sound like my thing because that seemed sort of, I don't know, like I feel like the goal, like I always have like if I have goals, they're always narrative. I always, and they're not, so style is extremely important to me, but style in service of telling a story rather than the other way around, I think. So yeah, so that sounds like, I don't know, like I'm trying to think of the really long sentence writers that I end up adoring are like Thomas Bernhard, you know, who I feel like you can speak his sentences out loud, and granted he's translated, and I'm told that in German it's even more amazing. But yeah, I like it to be, I want to be able to hear the voice. I don't want to be hearing a mind. I want to hear a voice. I want to hear a speaker.
Still on the narrator, you said in a previous interview that you like your narrators to be likable and relatable, and that works better for you when they're smarter and articulate. Which Belt certainly is. Was that a challenge, though, given his passivity and possible mental illness, certainly compared to Gurion, who's a very active, even though he's a kid, takes command, and he's the narrator of your first novel, The Instructions.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way it was, because I wanted to, you know, it wasn't challenging voice-wise. It was challenging to think, you know, how do I make what's happening dramatic when I have this sort of more passive fellow, because with Gurion, with The Instructions, it's a really violent book. I mean, this book has, you know, sort of
some violence
to eventually, but it's not generally committed by Belt or even to him, like even against him. So for me, the challenge really was figuring out how to move plot forward without violence. I'm a great fan of violence in books. I mean, in art, not in life, you know, but with The Instructions, there's a lot of fist fights. There's sort of any time in that book when I was like, all right, this is getting a little slower than I want it to be right now, I sort of cut back a few paragraphs and have someone punch someone, you know, it's like who's, you know, there's enough, like that book is built toward this sort of tension, this kind of constant tension of who is going to hit who next in a way. And whereas Bubblegum is not. So yeah, so with this, I think it was more, the challenge was having it be about someone who a lot of stuff happens to, but not having it feel like it's, I don't know, like it's a complaint. Like that, you know, and so that's, yeah, it might be too abstract. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, there's also the challenge, in the book, he communicates telepathically with inanimate objects like rusty swing sets, for example.
Sure.
And the reader, I guess, isn't really sure if the narrator is reliable in that respect. Is he really talking to the rusty swing sets or not? And that's not a question you really answer in the book. So I love the way you did that balance.
Thank you. Thank you.
But that must have been difficult. What's in his mind is not, and you don't want the reader to think one way or the other, I'm pretty sure, because I wasn't able to grasp which one was the actual reality in the book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that it goes along with, you know, with the way I want the reader to sort of view the curios, which is like, I want this, you know, these beings, whether they're animals or robots. I want these questions like to be more thought about than answered. And I think that there's different implications depending on what your angle is on them. And so with Belt, you know, whatever you decide about what the inanimate objects are saying to him, whether they're saying them to him or whether he is whether he's making them say these things to him, it hopefully narratively isn't that much of a difference in the end. Like, I think that in the end, like, whether he is somebody who is actually hearing inanimate objects or someone who is hallucinating them, his point of view, his perspective on the world actually isn't that different. It's whether one might trust him upon meeting him might be a little different. but once you get to know him, it's like, yeah, he's this guy who talks to inanimate objects, or he thinks he does, and what else is he? You know,
I thought you did an incredible job of world building. It's could be considered speculative fiction, science fiction, kind of alternate history, like Ross' Plot Against America, which is very big right now because it's on TV. Sure. There's a TV series. The present day of the novel is 2013, we mentioned. Belt is 38. He flashes back quite a bit to when he was 12, 1988. And there's some real life details from those times. There's the heavyweight championship bout between Tyson and Biggs. You mentioned Metallica playing Chicago's Aragon Ballroom in 1988. But and there's the stuff that doesn't exist, and that's the speculative sci-fi part. We mentioned the curios. They're flesh and bone robots, whether they're actual robots and machines or kind of a sentient light form. That's never really answered in the book. Mm-hmm. That's up to the reader. And by the way, they smell like bubblegum. So,
they do.
And as we read, or if the reader happens to stumble on the back cover first, we find out that there's no internet.
You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're re-airing a Between the Covers interview with author Adam Levin from back in May 2020. The occasion was the launch of Adam's novel Bubblegum from Doubleday. Adam's new novel, Mount Chicago, was just released this week.
Now, you've said you don't do a lot of planning ahead for a book. You don't like outlining because it kind of takes away a lot of the fun of the writing and discovering as you go along. Yeah. So how'd you go about building that alternate reality? I read that you started writing the Curio User's Manual first, this long instruction manual.
Yeah. When I finished the instructions, I wrote, I think like I mentioned earlier, I wrote, I think like a couple hundred pages about these Curios, and they were bad versions of it. Like it was, and there was a character. It was going to be like a young kid, but it was this sort of faster movie. It felt more sci-fi. And basically I didn't have a handle on what the Curios were, and I trashed all of it. But I was still really fascinated with the Curios. And so I sat down and I wrote an owner's manual or user's manual. And then that's the first thing that made it into this book, into Bubblegum. And because I liked it. And I started thinking, you know, sort of just first, you know, what's the world like around them? And I sort of knew a little bit about it because of the manual. And then it became, you know, who's going to talk about this world? Who's going to experience this world? And I thought of this character, Belt, that I tried to write about in a short story like a million times and failed to like 20 years earlier, almost like my second or third year at Syracuse. And yeah, and he was someone who inanimate objects spoke to, and his father got really monologous about a glass of water at one point. And like, I was like, I like that glass of water monologue. That's probably why I kept
trying to
write that story. Yeah. And so I really was like a decision that was, I kind of thought, okay, here's this one high concept thing with these curios. And then here's this other high concept thing with a guy that, you know, maybe does or doesn't talk to inanimate beings, inanimate objects. And I thought, this is a really, really bad idea to put these two things together. And so I wanted to do it. That's just, you know, like, it's sort of the way I decide to do things.
It's a challenge or just, hey.
Yeah, not just a challenge, not like I can do that. But like, it was interesting to me because I was like, both of these things seem kind of real to me. Like they seem like to me, they're real-ish, you know, I could make them real on their own. And like, how do I make them both real for someone else at once? So I wanted to figure out how to do that because it seemed like I would learn something by doing that, and I thought if it worked, it would be really exciting. hopefully it works. That's how it came about. And in terms of the world getting built, it really was like these questions would come up where I would say, okay, you know, how do I, you know, as the book goes on, I'm like, well, what do I think. These are robots or animals? Do I think this guy is talking to inanimate objects or is hallucinating? And that gives you it sort of starts narrowing things. And I'm just trying to tell the truth from the narrow perspective that I've put myself in, which is belts. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. In fact, what I loved about the book, though it seems a little bit overwhelming at first, is that Belt tells the story as if the reader lives in the same world as he does.
Right.
And has the same knowledge of that world. So he mentions the curios, the cures, as he calls them. Mm-hmm. And he has one of the first that started out as a bottomal and mm-hmm. now is a curio as the manufacturer has kind of perfected it as a consumer object.
Yes.
There's no exposition. We just kind of grasp more as we read and filling in the gaps. And then about halfway through the book, you actually insert those user manuals, one, not just the curios, but you have a separate one for the bottomal. They're extremely detailed. And then we actually have a kind of a Webster's Dictionary definition. What exactly is a curio? I'm just going to read it. A curio is a soft automaton with built-in, cutting-edge, senso-emotional call-and-response technology. The acronym is SECRT, S-E-C-R-T. So convincing, it almost might as well have a heart and a soul, even though it doesn't. The best sci-fi I've read, and speculative fiction, and I'm thinking here maybe of an Ursula Le Guin, uses the same technique. They trust the reader. They don't explain everything at first. You enter this world, and the characters assume that you're in the world with them and that you know what they do. Did you initially play around with the idea of putting those instruction manuals first to kind of clue in the reader, or
originally I had them first.
Ah.
It was funny. It was like, and it was just I had that and I had the sort of the maybe when I got to the opening 30 pages or something, I showed it to my old editor, Eli Horowitz, who's genius and who I just trust, and he was like, these manuals, man, like I can't enter into them. This part afterward about John Boat, I'm really interested in. And Eli can give you, I trust Eli's gut a lot. Like in like we like narratively similar thing. Like when we it's more that when we like the same things, we like them for pretty much the same reasons. Like he can communicate back to me sometimes better than I can what I'm enjoying about a book or a show or something. And I thought, maybe this guy's right. And so I started looking at it that way, and because I always want to be with the reader. I'm a pro reader kind of person. I'm not like a decode me kind of writer. I want to give a reader as rich an experience as I possibly can, and sometimes that means there's a bit slower entry than a film or something, would have. But I want them, I don't want to alienate them by a gesture. That's not that, no gesture is that important to me. So that manual started out at the front and then really quickly I got rid of them, and I saw.
I think it's a great choice because they're extremely detailed. They're helpful later in the book, and they're actually presented side by side on the page. The user's manual and the instruction guide for the curio, and they go on for about 20 pages that way. So I think it might have been a bit much, and by that time, the reader kind of knows a lot more about these, and because Belt has described his curio, and. Yeah. It's just kind of fun to learn more. And I started out as a technical writer in my career. So you do an amazing job of kind of getting that argot right. Well, you do throughout the book. There's a lot of slang in argot that you kind of make up and some that you kind of take from our world and put it into this world. Now, as mentioned, the internet doesn't exist in the novel. I wondered, did you have a particular reason for excluding it? Belt's world seems stranger without it, but maybe even preferable right now for some of us.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think part of it, you know, I want to say I had a particular reason, but I mean, it was definitely something that when I realized I'd gone a little ways, I was like, there's no internet in this book. And I'm not someone who feels like one has to write about any current technology. I'm sort of opposed to that as a notion, actually. But I think that I started really thinking that if these curios did get developed when they got developed, which is to say the 1980s, I don't think that the internet as we know it, at least, would exist right now. I feel like the way we use the internet is basically, I mean, the way scientists use it is one thing, and it's wonderful. You know, like they can communicate rapidly, et cetera. The way journalists use it is sometimes wonderful. It's become a little bit horrible. But on the whole, most people engage with the internet. The joke was it used to be for porn mostly, and I think probably still is largely for porn. But you know, to sort of be dicks to each other, to be cruel.
That's the social media part. Yeah,
there's the social media aspect, and it's people getting off on either. And sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes it's their, you know, I saw this and I cried. I was so moved and they announced it, you know, or, you know, on Facebook. I'm really not on much social media, so I'm going to sound like a very old man. But it's like on Facebook, I've been on Facebook since I think 2010 or something. And I just, you know, I just remember people posting all these RIPs, you know, it was like, and you started getting this sense that the second a celebrity died, it was like, you're going to race to Facebook to announce their death. And it's like, and they're like, rest in peace. I love their work. And like, you've rushed to be the first person to deliver bad news. Like that's what this is. Like it's so, and it's all this stuff that exists in, you know, regular society. It's just this gossip and cruelty, but it's on such a grand scale and it's so fast. And I think that's why people are as involved as they are with the internet and have such a hard time imagining themselves separate from it, because it really, you know, triggers these reward systems of anguish that are ugly inside us. But anyway, I'm not trying to be on a soapbox. I just thought that if you had these curios and the, you know, what gets done to them throughout the course of the book, the way that citizens of the world sort of treat these things, it's kind of similar. They're kind of whatever you want. You can be horrible to them. No one's going to fault you. You can be loving to them. No one's going to fault you. They're going to be very cute, you know? We like that stuff on the internet too, you know, like, you know, doggy videos. And I just thought I thought there wouldn't be a lot of appeal to it. It would be a curio would be a lot cooler thing to have than a Facebook account. Facebook wouldn't get monetized.
Adam, do you read Goodreads on the internet? I think it's owned by Amazon, but it's where readers can place their comments. There was one almost exactly like what you just said that I thought was the reader actually took a lot of time and actually personalized it. But this is an excerpt from that. If cures replace the curios, replace the internet and bubblegum, they are like the internet, a repository for what is most venal and stupid in us. Cures and virtual online interactive spaces both become domains in which impotent rage manifests itself pathetically and unavailingly. They both involve the grotesque consumption / despoliation of cuteness. That's really well written. I just wanted to get your take on that comment and maybe what this reader picked up on the role that rage and violence, and you mentioned the word cuteness, that plays in the novel.
Yeah. Well, so this is going to go against everything I just said. So this thing you just read from, which I agree is brilliant, actually. This person is someone I've never met him before. He's my friend on Facebook.
Oh, wow.
And he sent me this thing. He was like, I just posted this thing on Goodreads. And it's like, people do this. Like, I have friends on Facebook that, you know, are just readers that have contacted me. And, you know, I try to be, you know, nice and open as I can be to strangers. But this guy, he sent me this thing. And that whole review is amazing. His name, I think, is Jason Wazirba. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Uh-huh. But yeah, like that was one thing where I was like, go internet. I was really happy. I was like, cause it was in a way, it was one of the most rewarding experiences I've had as a writer, is this person reading my book that closely and understanding it and having his take on it. And he gets into a lot of other stuff. He gets into personal stuff. And
It's a long review. I urge listeners to kind of look it up on Goodreads.
Yeah, it's really well written, and it's fantastically reasoned, and it's huge. I mean, it's hugely complimentary to me. So it's like, this is, that was a great thing. And I already forgot your question, because I want this guy to write books. Like, this was, I read this thing. I was like, this is, you know, I care, you know.
I was going to try to get into the role that rage and violence play. He mentions that.
Oh, yes.
Maybe also, what did he say? The venal and the stupid, but, a rage and violence may be in relation to cuteness, which is a big part of the book. Curios are cute. And if people kind of overdose on the cuteness, they tend to do very violent and cruel things.
Yes. Yeah. Awful things. And, you know, there's that thing, like, you know, it's become a popular thing now where what are they calling cute aggression? Right. And so this is, you know, but this is an old thing. Have you heard of this? The cute aggression?
No, I've never heard that term.
There's these sort of there's sort of wackadoo theories about it. There's some things that are coming up that are interesting. But cute aggression is the thing where there are people. It's like there's two kinds of people according to this theory, what I've read of it at least. And there's people who see a cute thing and they're, oh, you know, it's just so cute, you know. And then there's other people who are like, it's so cute, I want to kill it, I want to eat it, I want to, you know, scoop its brains out, do the, you know. And they say these things and generally speaking, it's like there's a lot of people that are like that say that. And the theory, which like most psych theories that aren't behaviorist, I don't usually buy. But is that, you know, they don't really want to do this. I agree with that. I don't think most people see a little puppy and say, I want to eat it and really want to eat it. but that they're doing this to sort of regulate how over the top good they feel looking at this puppy, how engaged they are by it. Yeah, I mean, I think cuteness can drive people pretty nutty. I mean, so, as can beauty. I mean, it's, you know, and that these things are sort of distinct is interesting to me. And as far as the book goes, I mean, one of the thing with the curios, the reason I was excited about writing about them to begin with, the one thing I had right when I wrote those 200 pages that got trashed was that they're so cute, you're going to murder them. And so the notion that in the book, without giving too much away, but everyone accepts that they're robots in the book, or nearly everyone. And this is a sort of self-preserving thing, because if they're not robots, then doing the awful things that are done, that people do to them, means we're just monsters. And I mean, you could probably guess my stance on whether or not we're monsters. but like, that's one of the tensions in the book, you know? Yeah.
Well, Adam, thanks again for talking with us today. I got to say, if people are looking for a long, entertaining, funny, moving, and highly imaginative book to help get them through this coronavirus quarantine, I can't think of a better one than Bubblegum.
I really appreciate it, Ken. Thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
We've been talking with Adam Levin, author of the new novel Bubblegum from Doubleday. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Adam for joining us today through the miracle of the internet, and to all of you for listening.